Beauty Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate.
Kia ora and welcome to Muffin Talk. With this Muffin Talk, I would like to thank all of you for tuning into this radio program this year. And thank you to all my interview guests who have accepted my invitation to come to the studio this year. With this program, I would like to recall some highlights of our interviews of 2019, the year we named the Year of Gratitude. The interview guests on this program are Father Bernard Tau, the Imam and the Pastor, Lila O'Farrell, Father Tom O'Loughlin, Claire O'Higgins, Dr. John Paul, Brother Matthew of Tizzy, and Bishop Patrick Dunn. The pictures of these guests, along with their name and topic of each snippet, are on our website and Facebook page, Te Ngaka Wai Ora Mercy Spirituality Center. Here it goes.
In talking with Bishop Patrick Dunn, I had a number of conversations with him in my time here. And he was saying that one of the very important area of work is interfaith understanding and dialogue. And that's because the number of people who are coming into this country, they come from very diverse religious background. And so it is one of the very important areas for mutual understanding and the building of peace. And I come from a region in Singapore and Malaysia where we have multicultural, multi-religious experience. And so we have gone through our issues.
What kind of ethnic groups do you have in Singapore?
We have Chinese, we have Malays, we have Indians, we have Eurasians, we have... actually, it's a smorgasbord of an international community. Yeah. Same with Malaysia, but Singapore has gone even further, and that's because we have encouraged migration. And so, with that, you have people from diverse religious backgrounds, and we have had our religious conflicts before independence and after independence, and so. Singapore has a lot of experience in dealing with this multi-ethnic, multi-religious misunderstandings, as well as trying to find a common ground on where we stand together as a people.
What is one of the recipes, or one of the ways of how Singapore managed to get...
One of the very key things is because we... They emphasize political stability, social stability. And Singapore is so small, there's nowhere for us to go. So if the place is in constant strife, like you see in so many places, well, that's the end of us, and we will become a country of refugees. So.
And the Imam was talking about the power of turning the enemy into a friend. He said it's a metaphor. It's an ideology. It's a belief system. An attitude and a behavior that every Muslim must possess. Ability to turn the enemy into a friend. Say, by what? He said, the power of forgiveness. Identify someone who has hurt you dearly and extend the unconditional forgiveness. Don't expect him to come and say, I'm sorry. You don't need his I'm sorry. You don't need his apology. For you to be healthy, you need to let go, first and foremost. And to let go is to release that energy, that negative energy in you. When the Imam was talking this, I said, but Muhammad, I never hear this. He said, Muhammad did it in Makkah. Muhammad did it in Taif. Muhammad did it in Medina. He was giving different examples why the Prophet of Islam has done something similar that way. Because of that, I was crying that this is a new message I'm hearing. A message of love, of compassion.
After expressing forgiveness, after all that we have worked together, we started going around. First of all, we were supported by the British Council to go around Nigeria and set up Peace Institute for young people. and we started dialogue. And then later it now grew up to working with religious leaders. It wasn't easy because in those days, nobody wanted to see Christians and Muslims coming together. If they ever come together, it's to fight. And so we took the bull by the horn and started the initiative. I also had people who felt I was compromising my faith. They can invoke scriptures. Why do you unequally yoke together with unbelievers? And all those kind of terrible things. But I realized that the journey of my spirituality is embedded in what Jesus Christ will do. And Jesus has said, if we do promote peace, we are his children. And he said, we'll be blessed. And blessed are the pure in spirit, and all those wonderful beatitudes that comes to play. And so we begin going around where we have asked people to hate and tell them love is the solution. And truly, at this point, as we are talking, there are proliferation of interfaith initiative in Nigeria. But when we started, nobody will do that dirty thing because you are putting your life online to even try to engage. You'll be disowned. An elder one time in the church asked that I should be investigated. Am I still a Christian? Because I was working with the Muslim. So, but I realized that I was actually doing what Jesus Christ will do. He went to those that are poor. He went to those that are called sinners. He went to those that are... So reaching out to the others is the best way to come out of this. But Nigeria today, our initiative is respected. The Cardinal, John Cardinal Onaikon, of the Catholic, we have the Sultan, we have the President of Khan. All of them are in one kind of interfaith initiative or the other. But 26 years ago, that was not on the ground at all. So we are glad. We say the more, the merrier.
Well, I did spend about 20 years in North America. And when I was a much younger woman in my mid-20s, I was the director of a hospice society in British Columbia. And it was at that time that I began to encounter the grief and loss in my in the patient population, the people that we served. And I became very interested in how people used spirituality as a wonderful resource as they moved toward the end of life. And so this directed me toward chaplaincy as a vocation. And I did a year's clinical pastoral education training, a hospital residency, actually in Yuma, Arizona, very close to the border of the USA and Mexico, and went on to do my master's in interfaith theology. But it was really my hospice work that led me toward mindfulness. And I'll never forget one morning in Canada, the snow was thawing and I was trying to free some peonies from the snow, and I realized that I was worried about a hospice family. And I thought, my goodness, how can I renew and refresh myself and serve others well, you know, if I'm constantly ruminating upon the suffering that I'm witnessing and expected to support and alleviate in some way. And I talked to a woman in my community who said to me, why don't you try mindfulness meditation? She worked with children who had been harmed, and she found that mindfulness assisted her to be present and to care for herself and others. So I did that, and that was the beginning of my mindfulness journey.
The word didache literally means the training. It's the Greek word for training. And you have to imagine, we think of the early church as having things like the letters of Paul, and then later having documents like the Gospels. But quite apart from these, the letters of Paul were occasional things. They were occasioned by particular needs. And the Gospels are the written down recordings of gospelers who were coming to give a performance, an overview of the whole vision of Christian faith. But the people in the communities, in the local churches scattered all across the Mediterranean world, they needed something that would be their training. And the training began as something very simple, and it kept developing. And when it was still in the simple stage in the first and second centuries, it was something that every disciple of Jesus actually learned off by heart. Now, we knew that this existed because we had lots of references. They had learned the training, and they had read the training, and they had copied the training. And we knew, but everyone said, well, what was it like? And people said, well, it probably included the Lord's Prayer. Yeah, well, so much. You don't have to be brilliant to make that guess. It probably included something like some sort of variant on the Ten Commandments. Well, again, you wouldn't have to be very bright to make that guess. But then in 1873, a brilliant young Greek monk was working in a library in Constantinople, now Istanbul, cataloguing books. And the funny thing about this particular librarian was he had already spent a couple of years in Germany, and indeed he had there met all of the great editors. So as he was going through the book, his mind was alerted to be looking out for unusual things, and he discovered a copy of the Didache, a copy of the Didache that reflects the way the Didache was used in Greek around 80 AD. And this is the most precious document we have from the Christians from the first century that's not in the New Testament, and it's even more precious because all of the documents in the New Testament were special documents. This is the ordinary document. This gives us an insight into what was actually happening in a local church at the time. And so, for instance, it's got a very detailed list of do's and don'ts. And then we thought, well, that's very unusual. And then we found in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, we thought, ah, now we have a copy in Aramaic of the same thing that we find in a Christian document in Greek. And we realized that an awful lot of the moral practice that the Christians were putting forward to these Greek converts to the religion of Jesus, wasn't yet called Christianity, in the middle of the first century, they're actually using a document that was being used for training little Jewish boys and girls back in Palestine, which we had also lost. Human beings are almost incurably religious, even if they're not very obviously religious, or even if they say they're not religious. There is this somehow sense that there's something larger, there's mystery. And once you actually say there is mystery, you seek to address it. And it's that address that's prayer. Where Christian prayer comes in is that Jews and Christians and Muslims would say that they're is a dialogue between God and the individual, and between dialogue and the human family. And that dialogue takes the form of the invitation to pray. And so all three religions have had structures for prayer that are based around the day, based around the week, based around seasons, and then based around the year. So popular devotions are one expression of this very basic human reality. And they can be found in all the three great monotheisms, and they can be found in various forms among all the different forms and flavors and colors of Christians.
It's almost part of human being to have that tendency.
Part of being a human being is not only to be aware of oneself and to be aware of the wonder of the people around you and the wonder of the creation, but something more than wonder, the mystery. And then to seek to put words on it, and then to be aware that the mystery is in relation to you. And this relationship evokes prayer. But every Christian who is listening to this program has a vocation. And it's a vocation to be the presence of God in a particular place and to do a particular thing which no one else in the universe can do. In their world, they have a particular task and a particular calling, and the Holy Spirit is empowering them as much as he's empowering the presbyter in the church building on a Sunday morning. And the key thing is for each individual Christian to be listening for what is their unique calling and what is their unique challenge and what is their unique gift. And it's always a mixture of need and gift. There is a situation that needs addressing, and we all can. No one can do everything, and you can't play all the instruments in the orchestra. So what you have to do is you have to try and figure out, well, here is a particular need, and this is a need that might only exist for a day, a week, a year. It might exist for the whole of your lifetime. And then it's to see, well, what gifts have I that I can bring to this situation? And then there may be something else, that not only what gifts have I, but how can I improve those gifts? Because we all know that a gift is a great thing, but a little bit of practice really is wonderful as well. And a little bit of thinking, a little bit of learning can often take a natural skill and turn it into something really useful. So when I hear people saying, oh, we're having prayers for vocations, I hate it to think that this is some sort of thing where we just want more presbyters or we just want more deacons. I think what we want to be doing is we want to be praying that every Christian, every single member of the baptized, is tuning in more to this unique thing, that there's something that they can do that individual can do, that no one else can do. And then another aspect of this is I see in many Catholic dioceses there's a thing called the vocations office. And if I meet the person who's in charge of that, who's invariably a presbyter, and I say to them, so you're the director of vocations? And he says, yes. So I said, well, if I wandered in off the street, would you be able to help me to discern my own vocation? He sort of looks at me. And what we actually need is to start thinking in terms of if there's a vocations office, it's to help this person or that person. Because often talking about vocation and talking about situation is the way you discover your vocation. And then when we've got lots of you, then the Catholic Church, well, it needs to address this whole question. In an earlier age, celibacy made sense in the Catholic Church because it adopted a very clear belief that there were two grades of Christian, those who were on the way of the commandments, and they were just ordinary people like my mother and father, and then there were those who were on the way to perfection. They were sisters and those who were presbyters, the clergy. And it was very much a two-tier vision of the world, and it was a two-tier vision of holiness. And so, for instance, no one would have thought in 1950 of putting the vocation of being married and looking after a family and building up the society of the family and as equal to the vocation of a presbyter. But of course, that is one of the great insights of the last 50 or 60 years in Catholicism, and one of the things that has to match that is, of course, the whole question of, we have to address again the whole question of compulsory celibacy. And indeed, one of the interesting things that's happening right now is that Pope Francis is actually hearing requests from places like South America, where there's a vast need not only for every Christian to hear their own vocation, but for these very public ministries, and where they're saying is, well, we know there are people there who have all the skills, and this can be part of their vocation, and if only this technical question were resolved, we would suddenly have lots more ministers. So that's, I see this as a time of, this is where the Catholic Church is at a crossroads. At the one hand, it has to rediscover vocation. At another level, it has to change some structural things. And it also has to remember that most of the Christian clergy in most of the churches, for most of the time, have all been married. Just, we think of the Greek Church, the Coptic Church, the Armenian Church, all of these churches. These are ancient churches going all the way back to the time of the apostles, as much as the Latin Church, and of course they've never had this discipline outside of monasteries.
Claire, we've talked about a little bit about the classes, the Lookout for Better classes. They are running every month, and once a month you come to the Mercer Spirituality Center, as you said. What do you like at our center?
It was a really lucky day when we actually found your centre. I have to say that Look Good, Feel Better actively looks for centres that are out of the hospital environment. We do hope that, you know, when we do that, it means that somebody's away from treatment. When we found your wonderful rooms, what struck us first of all was the beautiful setting. And for the women to be able to sit in the room and see your beautiful gardens just gives them a sense of lightness and brightness as well. And Lynn, our volunteer photographer, who actually goes to all of our centres in Auckland, loves coming to Mercy on a Wednesday, because your gardens, we, as much as we can, take the photographs there of the women when they've finished the class, so they have a memento of the day. And often it's the images that the family and friends just go, you know, today was a good day for mum, or look at that picture. And your centre actually is just such an important area for us, so we thank you very, very much.
John, you're a Lutheran pastor, professor, and community activist. What made you write a biography on Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish Muslim?
It's a great question. Of course, it's a big question as well. My previous book was on religions and violence. The title of the book is Empire of Sacrifice, The Religious Origins of American Violence. And it looked at the way people, unfortunately, misused and abused religion to create harm along the lines of age, race, and gender in American history. It was not a pleasant book to write. It was painful. So as a sequel to that book, I began looking at religious peace builders, people around the globe who have taken their faith, practiced it with integrity, which produces inner peace, of course, but which also can inspire movements for peace. So people such as Mohandas Gandhi, or the recent Nobel Peace Prize winner, who happens to be a Lutheran, Lima Bowie. These individuals have inspired greater justice and peace in their communities and in their nations by drawing on the deep wells of spirituality and theology to unite people. So I was studying a variety of these examples, and Mr. Gulen jumped out to me as someone who has not yet had a critical biography written in English. So as I grew more familiar with him and his writings, and as I grew more familiar with the people of Hizmet, the people of service, like the folks here of the...
Pearl of Island Foundation.
Yes, the Pearl of Island Foundation.
And Hizmet means service.
Hizmet means service in Turkish. Yes, that's correct. As I became more familiar with those people, I really saw analogies between the kinds of movements that Gandhi and Lima Bowie and Martin Luther King Jr. and Lech Walesa and Poland and Mother Teresa, Sister Helen Prejean in the United States had inspired. And so I undertook to study Turkish and began the research in 2010. And I was honestly looking for a happier story. Of course, unfortunately, many of the events in Turkey recently have turned tragic. And I should have known this because religious peace builders are often among the people who are targeted most by demagogues and by people in power through slander, through propaganda, and through falsehoods. And that's been the case with Mr. Gulen and people close to him as well, unfortunately.
My generation, we lived in fear of the Cold War, you know, of the nuclear bomb and all this. For a later generation, after 2001, yeah, September 11th, it was fear of terrorism. Today, yeah, it's climate change, yeah, which many of the 15, 16, 17-year-olds are extremely worried about. And yes, we try to listen to that in Teze, and to try to understand what is God saying to us through these concerns. It's important for us always to listen to those who come to visit us, not to kind of impose some kind of opinion upon them or a program upon them. I think one thing which I notice as well is that in my youth, we were very strong on social justice issues, and perhaps there was less emphasis on prayer. You know, we were very active. And at that time, there was a need to speak a lot more about prayer. Today, many people have their own spirituality. The vertical connection is there between them and their God. But the idea of belonging to a community, accepting to be part of a body of other believers, that's not so simple.
No other officials are there apart from a translator. We had a Nigerian priest from Brisbane, Australia, funnily enough, Father Anthony, who has family in Brisbane and family in Nigeria. And Pope Francis would speak in Italian, and I think most of us can get the drift of what he was saying, but then Father Anthony would just translate into English to make sure it was clear for us. And similarly, when we were speaking, I got the impression that Pope Francis could understand English, but Father Anthony would just translate to Italian for him, just to make sure that he had understood what we were saying. And sometimes we were interrupting Father Anthony when he was trying to search for a word. We might say, what about this? And he'd say, oh, yes, it's a good word. But it was very non-intrusive. It's amazing how freely the conversation could flow. As I think, Beata, you might know, because you're a translator yourself.
Yeah, I did that a long time, yeah. And I think that's also a sign of the Universal Church, having a pope from Latin America and a translator or interpreter from Nigeria and bishops from New Zealand. That's really universal. And then meeting in Rome.
Absolutely. Actually, one of the things that Pope Francis said when we walked in, he said, I'm from Buenos Aires, from the south too. And I was thinking, well, so was Father Anthony. So we were all from the south, yes. And I said we would love to welcome Pope Francis to the periphery, and made the point that Auckland is the largest Polynesian city in the world, and it would be a mecca for people from all the Pacific Islands if he were able to come. When we met with him personally, I was thinking, I don't think I can put that burden on him. I'll leave it to the department to let him know that he's been invited. I think when we raised the issue, they very politely rolled their eyes. I think they just put our name on the list.
Who knows? Francis might have the idea, oh, yes, let's go to the periphery.
Well, that's right. And we made that point. We know that he likes the peripheries.
You can't get further than New Zealand.
Yeah, we made that point. That's right.
So how long? So the official part of the visit was two days?
No, we were in Rome for 8 or 9 days.
8 or 9 days, yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. And so the next visit to the Pope will be in how many years? In 6 years?
No, the visit before this was 8 years ago. I think as the number of bishops grows, that the visits become more pronounced, more extended. I guess the Pope just tries to work through a list, and our turn will come around again, I guess, in 8 or 9 years' time.
So maybe that's the reason why Pope Benedict preferred having group meetings, if you just mentioned that the number of bishops is growing.
Yes, absolutely. I think the group meeting is more productive, and it's probably more enjoyable for the bishops and for the Pope himself too.
Yeah. And so what do the bishops from New Zealand take back from Rome and from the experience?
I think we take back a great appreciation of Pope Francis and his groundedness. And he encouraged us with the initiatives that we were taking here in New Zealand. He was very interested to know what we were doing with young people, and sort of saying that we need to be very open and transparent with the questions of young people, like not just giving them pat answers, but try to hear what are they actually asking, what do they want to know, and then try to answer as honestly as we can.
I hope you enjoyed these snippets. Please remember that our office is now closed until we resume on the 15th of January 2020. For any requests, you may still contact us per email at info@mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. Those of you who are on our mailing list will have received our new program booklet for 2020. Our theme will be presence. We have put together an interesting and diverse program. If you haven't received the booklet and it is not displayed in your parish, please send us an email. And I wish you all the best for the last days of the year 2019 and the first days of 2020. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and all the best. Thank you very much.